Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
The case of the Golden State Killer has raised profound questions about ethical uses of DNA and how popular DNA testing and genealogical services can be used or misused without users' knowledge. We have three experts on the subject with us. Ellen Wright Clayton is professor of law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, professor of health policy, and co-founder of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University Medical School. She's co-author of the book Bioethics in Law and co-author of Privacy and Security in the Genomic Era, Imagined Futures, Capturing the Benefits of Genome Sequencing for Society, and the Legal Risks of Returning Results of Genomics. Mark Rothstein is Chair of Law and Medicine and the Founding Director of the Institute for Bioethics, Health Policy, and Law at University of Louisville School of Medicine. He's co-author of Genetics, Ethics, Law, and Policy, and the editor of Genetic Secrets, Protecting Privacy and Confidentiality in the Genetic Era. He's also co-editor of Behavioral Genetics, The Clash of Culture and Biology. Dennis McNevin is professor of forensic genetics in the Center for Forensic Science at the University of Technology at Sydney. He is co-author of Predictive DNA Analysis for Biogeographical Ancestry, Forensic DNA Phenotyping, Developing a Model Privacy Impact Assessment, and Prediction of Biogeographical Ancestry from Genotype.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you with us. What prompted this particular panel was the news story about using DNA to track down the Golden State Killer. And I thought this opens up a whole range of implications, both in the legal area, but also in medical, in personal, in the idea of discrimination based on DNA, privacy concerns. And so I thought we should start with the use of DNA in law enforcement and see if we can understand how these are done. Dennis McNevin, can you start us on this?
Sure. So the traditional use of DNA for forensic investigations has involved simply looking at genetic markers that are good at identifying people. They have no other value. They tell us very little about the individual. And if there is a match between crime scene evidence and an individual that's either on a database or a suspect, then that's very strong evidence linking that individual to the crime scene. However, that's not always the case. And quite often there's no match, and that lead will go nowhere otherwise. And so there's a big push to try and extract more information from that DNA to tell us more about the person who left that DNA behind. And obviously, in recent weeks, we've seen with the Buckskin Girl and the Golden State Killer, we've seen instances where that DNA that's been retrieved from a crime scene has been used to tell us more about the donor of that DNA. And in this particular instance, it's involved uploading to genealogy, direct-to-consumer websites where putative relatives have been identified.
I see Mark Rothstein, you have joined us now. I wonder if you might want to add to this. We're trying to understand, first of all, this use of DNA, and in particular because of the Golden State Killer, where they use this means that Dennis was just talking about. What would you add to this in terms of using these investigations, how they're changing, and what this means?
Well, there's always been an interest in expanding the capabilities of DNA forensics. And we saw very recently how that might be done through indirect and familial searches. And in a case like the, all of us were pleased from a law enforcement standpoint that the probable or possible perpetrator of these horrible crimes was finally brought to justice after such a long period of time. But my concern is with the implications of this and how it might be extended to other cases. And I don't think there's been adequate discussion of the sort of the due process and the privacy interests that we all have in balancing law enforcement with the rights of citizens.
Now, I understand what actually happened in this case, and this is just totally based on news stories, so please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the law enforcement officers actually went into one of the genealogy databases and uploaded the DNA, and I think it was GED Match in particular, which was founded by volunteers and trying to help people build their family trees, and that they were able to track down this killer based on DNA that his family members might have uploaded. What actually happened? Is this an accurate portrayal of what happened? And what does that mean, Mark Rothstein?
Well, I think that's a pretty fair summary. My understanding is that actually the link was made to DNA that was posted by a 73-year-old man in Oregon who turned out to be his third or fourth cousin. And when that individual consented, they got his DNA, and then they went through the family tree, basically, and developed a list of possible suspects. There's a second level of concern here, and that is once they focused on Mr. D'Angelo, they obtained DNA from some unspoken, unidentified, yet refuse that he put out. It could have been, you know, a cigarette butt or used chewing gum or a variety of things that he discarded. And then the police tested that and they were able to get a complete match with the crime scene evidence. So, I mean, there are a whole series of concerns in terms of the, not so much the legality. I think what they did was legal, but the implications and the policy that we need to consider.
Well, let's start going through some of these implications. Ellen Wright Clayton, let's bring you in. Why don't you start us down this path of implications?
Well, one of the things about this case is that when you post your DNA, it obviously implicates all of your biological relatives. And that was how the match was made here. And so one question that you can ask about is, should you be able to post your DNA this way? In other genealogic databases, you actually have to get permission from the person who is identified or who the match is made to see if they're willing to be in contact with you. What they did in this database was they put their DNA up there with a name, and then you could easily trace the family from that. But one of the questions from a family perspective is, should one family member be able to control what another family member does? And this is something that certainly both ethically and certainly legally is fairly problematic, to say that because I don't want you to identify me, you can't do with your DNA what you want. Now, I think the ethical question you can ask is it appropriate to make a database like this where, you know, where you don't protect the identity of the person? And so then it becomes fair game to trade everybody down to identify everyone downstream.
It's fascinating development with these genealogy databases because of exactly what you said, which is that should I not want my DNA shared, but a relative has shared his or her DNA, then I'm automatically shared in some way. Is that correct, Ellen?
That's correct. And I will say that there's nothing new about this. I mean, there was a case many years ago in Sweden where the Swedish prime minister was killed, and the perpetrator was identified by just exactly this kind of familial tracing, actually in this case, using a newborn blood spot. So there's nothing new about familial tracing. It's just that so many people are putting out so much identified DNA that the law enforcement can go after.
Dennis McNevin, what would you add to this conversation?
I would support Ellen's comment there that there's nothing new about this. Familial searching has been occurring not just on genealogy direct-to-consumer databases, but also in criminal DNA databases, where police are able to search against records of usually people who have been convicted and charged with a crime of a certain level of seriousness. And because of the high incidence of recidivism, some leads have been generated this way. I guess the other thing that we need to consider is that DNA is just one form of intelligence that leads police to suspects. So really, social media is one of the first ports of call for forensic investigators these days. Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, all those things leave a digital trace of your history. And there's probably a lot more information about individuals on their Facebook pages than there is that is obtainable at the moment anyway from DNA. And I guess we have to look at DNA as just another form of information about people. Now, there is something that people hold sacrosanct about DNA. It is a little bit of a sacred cow. People do consider DNA to be off limits. However, the reality is that there is probably a lot more information about people on social media, and people seem to be a little less concerned about police investigating Facebook pages, for example, to look of potential suspects and where relatives and social connections could just as easily be established.
Mark Rothstein, would you agree with that assessment?
I think that's right. Today, people are putting all sorts of information about themselves and, by implication, their loved ones online for, in many cases, anyone to see. And in a case like this, I mean, the GED match had this disclaimer on the website that said, you know, this is accessible to anyone, and if you're not comfortable with that, you shouldn't put it up, or you should take it down. Well, the fact of the matter is that these sorts of warnings and disclaimers and consents, people rarely read. They just sort of click through. We've been becoming numb to these kinds of notices on the internet. And I'm afraid without much forethought. And this case, I think, from an ethics and policy standpoint, is very important because it puts the issues right out in front of us. And we would be wise to, you know, not just move on to the next item in the news cycle and spend some time trying to figure out how we want to balance the interests of society with law enforcement.
I think there are other issues in addition to law enforcement mistakes, for example, but also some things that Ellen Wright Clayton has written about in terms of discrimination based on DNA, and also the issue, and I think, Dennis, this was in your work, about the possibility of DNA surveillance. So let's start to break down what some of these sort of worst-case scenarios might be and what we might think about in terms of prevention. Ellen Wright Clayton, now, before we get into this, these concerns that you raised in your articles, in your hundreds and hundreds of articles, I thought perhaps we should also talk about that survey that you did of these companies and what you have found, including these companies that share or that include the DNA from people who've shared other people's DNA without consent. Can you walk us through what you found on these various DNA genetic genealogy websites?
Well, it's nothing short of amazing, and I have to give full credit to our postdoc, James Stark. But he went through 90 privacy policies for direct-to-consumer companies. And although some of them are actually really pretty strong, namely the ones you would think of, 23andMe and Ancestry.com, others of them simply say nothing. And then it turns out that more than half of the websites are actually for surreptitious testing, to look at things like proving infidelity or proving lack of parentage, other things of that nature, which are really designed to be very, very disruptive. First of all, obviously, the person whose DNA is being stolen or submitted surreptitiously has no control over what's going on. But the people who were also doing the submitting have no earthly idea what's going to happen to that DNA and what the results are going to be. So it really is the Wild West out there. I think before we go on to the discrimination issue, I do want to make a point here that at least in the United States, forensic DNA databases broadly overrepresent minorities and mostly minority males. And so there's not a chance in the world that Mr. D'Angelo, a white former cop, would have been in those forensic databases. And so one of the things that's an interesting thing here, at least in terms of a justice concern or a discrimination concern, is that the only way they could have found him was going through a genealogy database, which, by the way, are largely populated by people who are of Northern European ancestry. So I think that there's something really interesting here about the fact that that was the only way they could have caught him, was by going through a genealogy database, because our forensic databases wouldn't have had him.
Now, you talked in one of these articles about how this DNA can be misused, and in particular with things like making sure you're covered medically and making sure you can have work. What about those issues?
I want to pick up on a comment that Dennis made earlier. We have some laws, they're not very good, that at least address that in the context of access to healthcare and access to work. Actually, the Obamacare was sort of solved that problem in the United States, at least with regard to access to healthcare in a major way. But what I find interesting is that I'd rather lose my DNA before a whole host of other information. If I lost my electronic medical record, if my finances got hacked, those things are much more worrisome to me than if someone were able to get my DNA sequence.
Before you go on, Ellen, why is it that you're not as concerned about your DNA as you are about medical records, given what might be able to be done with your DNA?
Because frankly, what's in my medical record says more about me as I am, as a product of genetics and environment and many other things, than my DNA sequence ever will.
I support what Ellen says 100% there. I think we should be...
Is that Dennis?
Yes, it is.
Dennis
Sorry.
McNevin.
Sorry, it's Dennis here. Yeah, look, I think we should be equally concerned about what's in the digital sphere as our DNA. I mean, there is so much information. Mobile phones are tracking devices. As Mark commented earlier, people are becoming numb to consent, to the fine print, and just press consent on apps all the time. And so we allow Google and Facebook to track our locations. And every time we make an automatic withdrawal of cash from an auto teller, that's logging information about us. Every time we go through an automatic road toll, that's logging information about us. I mean, there is a lot of information in the digital sphere that has to be protected just as much as DNA, in my opinion.
Are all of these types of data, whether they are coming from DNA or whether they're coming from your social media, all of those types of things, are they all stored in law enforcement databases today?
This is Dennis here. So no, they are not. The only things that are stored in law enforcement databases, in Australia anyway, I can't comment about the US, is DNA and fingerprints. The legal principle here is that if you are convicted of a crime and you achieve a level of a certain seriousness, then you sacrifice the right to the privacy over your DNA and your fingerprints. So that information is stored on a database against your will. Now, that only applies to that information. So other digital information is not stored by law enforcement databases. However, that's not to say that warrants can't be issued to access that information if there are fair and reasonable grounds for police investigators to think that that's a reasonable avenue of investigation.
Mark Rothstein, what about the USA?
Well, the US law enforcement does not routinely collect all of the ancillary matters that they could through the internet. They have fingerprints and, for some individuals, a DNA sample. And the question I think that we need to answer in the U.S. as well as everywhere else is, in an information-rich era, how much do we want the government and law enforcement to routinely, without a warrant, without probable cause, compile about individuals? Do we want the government to be able to aggregate in a sort of a big data sense all these diverse things that are where we've been and what we spend our money on and what books we've ordered and who our friends are, et cetera, to try to get a picture of us for whatever purposes might be used? I think the recent scandal, if you will, with Facebook is another sort of a rude shock to many of us that it's hard to even fathom the range of nefarious purposes that composite information can be used. And it's going to get really out of hand unless we kind of get our arms wrapped around it.
Well, maybe that's what we should do in our last few minutes, is talk about what are some of the ways that this information, whether it is harvested from our DNA, from our family's DNA, from our Facebook page, from our telephones, what are the protective ethical policies that we can advance to protect this basic, what we would consider generally as a fundamental right? Ellen, would you like to start?
Yes, I'd love to. I think, first of all, we need to think about putting controls on, you know, what the government does when they use these data. And I think that we ought to consider what kinds of prior permission, like warrants or other things that they need to use in order to access these data. And frankly, one problem in the United States is that our courts have been much more permissive about when you can collect DNA information from people than has been the case around the world. So I think those are important issues. The other thing that I think is really important is that we need to be really serious about what the big data tech companies are collecting and how they are distributing it for use by other people. Because, you know, frankly, in some ways, Facebook and Google have much more information about me than the federal government does. And their control of how it's used is absolutely not transparent to me or to anyone else. And I think that we need to think not only about what the government's doing, but also about what data aggregators are doing with all these data.
Dennis McNevin.
I'm not an expert on digital data, but if I can return to the subject of DNA, then you know, one thing we can do is instigate a process of what's termed sequential unmasking. And that's where we only look at the information that's relevant to the purpose at hand. So for a forensic investigation, if you're extracting a DNA profile, then we don't sequence the whole genome of an individual because that's too much information. Firstly, it's too expensive to do anyway on a routine basis. But secondly, most of the DNA sequence is irrelevant for the purposes of forensic investigation. So we would first look at only those genetic markers that might provide a DNA match. If a match occurs, there's no need to go any further. We're led to a suspect. If there's no match, then we only look at a few more genetic markers that might tell us about what that person looks like. Their hair color, their eye color, for example, perhaps their genetic ancestry, which would give us another lead. And so in this way, we sequentially release information from the genome and don't look at the rest of it. We purposely don't analyze the rest of the DNA data. And that's perhaps one protection that we could put in place to ensure that there's some level of genetic privacy.
I think it was your work, Dennis McNevin, that looked at sort of a comparative protection of genetic information. I think you said Australia deems it as sensitive and the European Union does as well, but the U.S. does not. What do we know about the level of protection there?
Well, I can't comment on the U.S. I'll leave that to your other two guests. But the problem in Australia and Europe and many parts of the world is that the legislation is largely silent about the use of DNA. The Netherlands has specific legislation that dictates exactly what DNA can be used for in forensic investigations. And the highest court in France has also, in 2014, issued a ruling about the use of DNA for forensic purposes. But otherwise, around the world, there's very little that's been said legally. And the problem here is that technology has run ahead of the law, and the law has got to catch up. I guess this is probably going to play out in the courts in terms of test cases, but it's a frontier that's largely unknown legally, and I think we need to watch this space to see what happens in the courts.
Mark Rothstein.
Well, I'd like to talk about just one sort of concrete thing that I think would be very helpful. The law has developed in the United States that once an individual abandons an item let's say chewing gum or cigarette butt or anything, then anyone who picks it up can do whatever they want with it, including DNA testing. And I think this is a great source of mischief in the United States, as Ellen talked earlier about some of these rather sleazy websites that will do any DNA testing on any object that you send in as long as you send the money. It's used for purposes that are sort of extrajudicial. In the UK, legislation was enacted that bans non-consensual genetic testing. And I think that would be something that we ought to look at in the United States. In the years to come, not only will we be able to send a chewing gum sample or a child's lollipop to a laboratory with new handheld technology using nanopores, we might actually be able to do it ourselves. And I think that what we don't want to have is a nation of people who are, you know, willy-nilly doing curiosity or pernicious testing of family members and others.
Final word, Ellen Wright Clayton.
I think this has been a wonderful conversation, and it just really shows that we're trying to figure out how to move forward as individuals in a big data society. And these exactly are the kinds of conversations we need to be having.
Well, I thank the three of you very much. I think it calls out for a part two very soon. I thank you for your time, your research, and your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Ellen Wright Clayton is professor of law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, professor of health policy, and co-founder of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University Medical School. She's co-author of the book Bioethics in Law and co-author of Privacy and Security in the Genomic Era, Imagined Futures, Capturing the Benefits of Genome Sequencing for Society, and the Legal Risks of Returning Results of Genomics. Mark Rothstein is chair of law and medicine and the founding director of the Institute for Bioethics, Health Policy, and Law at University of Louisville School of Medicine. He's co-author of Genetics, Ethics, Law, and Policy, and the editor of Genetic Secrets, Protecting Privacy and Confidentiality in the Genetic Era. He's also co-editor of Behavioral Genetics, The Clash of Culture and Biology. Dennis McNevin is professor of forensic genetics in the Center for Forensic Science at the University of Technology at Sydney. He is co-author of Predictive DNA Analysis for Biogeographical Ancestry, Forensic DNA Phenotyping, Developing a Model Privacy Impact Assessment, and Prediction of Biogeographical Ancestry from Genotype.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster,
Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin,
Anais Amin,
Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.